This week we're finishing up with purgatory. Attendance is down this week. Do you know what the remnant is? You know what the remnant is?
Yeah. The small group that's left.
Yeah. And there are all these calamities that occurred to the Israelites and throughout history and such. And there's always a remnant. So that's what we've got. We've got the essence.
It's early.
Yeah. Oh, it's early?
15 more minutes.
Probably so. By the way, this is the 750th anniversary of Dante's birth. I didn't think of that before. But he was born in probably in June, 750 years ago. We talked about, Dante's big on free will. And that we all have the ability to choose. And then there was that passage about why are things so messed up? It's because we have bad leaders and people are following the leaders, which seems to contradict the contradict free will. But Dante, said it doesn't matter what your leaders are doing. You don't have to follow along. But there are some interesting studies along this line. And one was done in 1961 by Dr. Stanley Milgram at Yale University. And he got a bunch of students, recruited a bunch of students, and he set them up to deliver electric shocks to a person in the next room where they could hear the person but not see the person. And in actuality, it was a tape recording and an actor. And so they were delivering increasingly intense shocks up to the point where the room fell silent and there was no more movement. The person's dead or unconscious. And they're to deliver three lethal shocks of electricity. Guess what happened? The majority of them did it. They did do it?
Oh.
That was, says 65% of participants delivered the final series of shocks. And it was because the guy was there with his white coat, he dressed up, like a doctor, real professional. Let's do this experiment. This is what you need to do. And they carried it all the way up. Bad leadership. Right? But you kind of wonder about free will. Then there's another study that was done at Stanford by Philip Zimbardo. Got 21 undergraduates, and supposedly, these are the intelligent, most stable people, and he set them up to make a play or to enact a prison setup. So they had divided the 21 between prisoners and guards, and they dressed the guards up, with the uniform and actually gave them sticks and everything to make them feel like a guard, gave them sunglasses that were mirrored, just like on the cop shows. And then the prisoners, they put in prison guard and shackled them and called them by number rather than name. And they set this up and put it in action. And very quickly, the prisoners assumed a prisoner type of persona. And the guards assumed a guard type of persona, and it actually got to the point where 10% of the guards were sadistic. And think of Abu Ghraib. They dressed these soldiers up like as guards, gave them authority, and what happened? Same thing that happened in this experiment is that some of them went overboard just because of being placed in that setting. Kind of makes you wonder about the free will issue. They had an ability to choose, but they chose to become sadistic. And then the last one is really humorous, which is it was done at Princeton Theological Seminary, and they got a number of seminary students and divided them into two groups. One group read the Good Samaritan passage and were told to develop a sermon on the Good Samaritan. All right? that they were going to give a sermon on the Good Samaritan. The other group was told to develop a talk on employment opportunities at the seminary, right? Then they were told, okay, it's time, you need to go give your talk. And some of them were told, oh, wait, you need to hurry over there. And then the other group was told, take your time, you know, it's okay. And along the way, they had positioned an actor who seemed to be in distress. And the question was, who would stop? What do you think the results of that were?
The Good Samaritan people stopped.
No.
No, it was the opposite?
Well, there were no better than the folks that were there to deliver an economic message. And the deciding feature of whether they stopped or not was whether they were in a rush or not.
Yeah,
yeah, isn't that interesting? So, you know, they had even studied the Good Samaritan. They're going to go give a talk on the Good Samaritan. But they didn't stop at any greater frequency than someone to give an economic message. And so you kind of do wonder, what governs our behavior? It does make you wonder. Well, this is the last week in purgatory. And so we'll start, Pilgrim is going to ask Virgil to define love, which is the source of every virtue and every vice. And last week, Virgil discussed love from a limited perspective, that of the seven mortal sins. In the organization of purgatory, that of rational love, that involves choice as opposed to natural love. And he discussed the harmful effects of mispurposed love. You know, love is good, but love that is for an object that, a lesser object, or love for a good object that is either too much or too little can be sinful. And this is Canto 18, lines 10 through 39.
Okay, this is Dante speaking to Virgil. I said, Master, the light you shed has made my sight so keen that now I clearly see all your words would mean or what they imply. So I beseech you, Father kind and dear, define love for me, please, which is to say the source of every virtue, every vice. And Virgil responds, now focus your mind's eye on what I say, and you will clearly understand the error of the blind who lead the blind. The soul at birth, created quick to love, will move toward anything that pleases it as soon as pleasure causes it to move. From what is real, your apprehensive power extracts an image it displays within you, forcing your mind to be attentive to it. And if attentive and inclines toward this, that inclination is called love. Nature it is which is through pleasure bound anew in you. Just as a fire's flames always rise up, inspired by its own nature to ascend, seeking to be in its own element. Just so the captive soul begins its quest, the spiritual movement of its love, not resting till the thing loved is enjoyed. It should be clear to you by now how blind to truth these people are who make the claims that every love is in itself good love. They think this, for love's substance probably always seems good, but though the wax is good, the impression made upon it may be bad.
So, one of the questions is, who are the blind? You know, the era of the blind who lead the blind, that's in the in 18. And the blind, in this case, are the Epicureans and follow of Epicurus, who lived 341 to 270 B.C., and he propounded an ethic that individual pleasure is the sole or chief good of life. So we should seek pleasure. And so that every love is a good love, basically. There's no such thing as a bad love. And they advocated living to derive the greatest amount of pleasure possible during one's lifetime, although they did advocate moderation so that you didn't go overboard or have overindulgence. But they maintain that every kind of love is good because it's natural and tending toward the good. And what Dante says is that can appear that way. And we are certainly drawn objects that we desire, but we still need to temper our temper our desire and behavior. In lines 19 through 33, he elucidates three stages of love. First, we're drawn to anything that pleases us. Second, we first love an image and not the object itself, so we see something that we love. And then this is the first inclination towards love. And then, as the fires, flames always rise up, the soul moves toward what gives its pleasure. This is the second stage of love, so we move toward that. And then the captive soul begins its quest, not resting till the thing itself is enjoyed, which is the third stage of love. So we are enticed by something, and then we seek to possess it, and then we reach out and enjoy the thing itself. Think of money, for instance, where we have an image of money, and then we're enticed toward that. But we can be enticed, to having money satisfies that longing. But you can desire too much. That can affect your behavior in desiring too much. And also you can desire too little. And so that there's these extremes, and the key is finding this median where it's healthy and right. In lines 34 to 39, again, the Epicureans described all love as good, but an object which is unworthy may kindle the good instinct of love into a wrongful passion. And so love is good, and the wax is good, but the impression that's made upon it may be bad. Let's look at lines 43. Oh, I should ask for any questions or comments. There being none, we'll go to 40 through 75.
This is Dante speaking. Thanks to your words and my keen interest, I know what love is now, I answered him. But knowing this brings more uncertainty. If love comes from a source outside of us, the soul having no choice, how can you praise or blame it for its love of good or bad? And he said to me, I can explain to you as much as reason sees. For the rest, you have to wait for Beatrice. It's the work of faith. Every substantial form, being distinct from matter, yet somehow conjoined with it, contains within it a certain power, not visible except as it is made manifest through its workings and effects, as life in plants is proved by their green leaves. So man cannot know where his cognizance of primal concepts comes from or is bent for those primary objects of desire. Bees are part of you, just like the zeal of bees for making honey. The primal will is neither laudable or blamable. That other wills conform to this first one, you have the innate facility of reason, which should defend the threshold of consent. This is the principle which is based the judgment of your merit, according as it winnows out the good love from the bad. Those men who with their reason probe the depths perceive this liberty innate in man, thereby bequeathing ethics to the world. Let us assume that every love that burns in you arises through necessity. You still have power to restrain such love. This noble power Beatrice knows as freedom of the will. Remember that if she ever should mention it to you.
Any thoughts about what he's talking about or trying to get at? I'm quiet class today. Normally y'all have lots of comments. This is one of the great questions, because Dante is so emphatic that we have the freedom to choose good over evil. And and that's the entire basis of the comedy. You end up where you are because of your choices that you make in life. And you're free.
Excuse me.
you're free to make good choices and you're free to make bad choices. And it doesn't matter what circumstances you're placed in, you still have this threshold of consent. And so he doesn't let anybody off the hook dependent upon their circumstances. So, again, Virgil can only go so far as reason is. We've talked about this before. Virgil is a symbol of reason. Reason can only take one so far. Past that point, you need faith. So faith takes you past reason.
So is, well, I don't understand what he's saying about reason.
Okay. In terms of...
In terms of reason, is he saying that you can explain love only as far as reason goes?
Correct. And, correct.
But man does unreasonable things all the time.
Exactly. Pascal is the heart has reasons that reason cannot know. And Pascal came after Dante. But that's exactly what Dante would say, is that
you react
rationally, but there are things for which we do not act rationally that are beyond rational explanation, right? There are things we do beyond rational explanation.
Well, yeah, and in the case of love, you made a good argument that you do things more irrationally.
Yeah. Well, his term of love, though, is wider than our term of love. You know, when we're speaking of love, we're speaking of love for another human being, right? He's talking about love for, you know, there's you have your sins, you have wrath, you have pride, you have envy, sloth, lust, and so forth. So there's he defines the actions within those categories as love. Now, we may not describe those as love, but he has a broad definition of what love is. Love is basically everything that governs our behavior. Does that make sense? There's a broader definition of love than we typically use.
That does make sense.
Yeah.
Is he referring only to earthly things in his definition, or is he referring to spiritual things as well?
Love is also for higher things, and that's in fact one of the things we'll find is the if you look, we're going to in fact talk in the next one. We're going to talk about the cardinal virtues of faith, hope, and love. There can be no excess of faith. There can be no excess of love. There can be no excess of hope. So the cardinal virtues, which are the spiritual virtues that you speak about, are different from the mortal. Virtues, mortal sins. All right, does that make sense? So that craving, you have a love for God, and in fact, if you remember last week, my heart is restless till it rests in you, and so we have a craving for the divine, and that is also part of what love is.
Right, and that's where he's talking about moderation.
Correct. He's talking. It ends up being moderation in all things except the divine.
Okay.
And then the divine, you can't. You know, there's no such thing as too much love for the divine. Yeah. Let's see. We'll go.
I just wanted to make sure I understood. So in this area, or what we're talking about now, is love, which is like desire or need. It's something that mm-hmm. we are drawn to.
Yeah.
And even, so I was looking at lines 70 to 72, even in necessity, even if we're poor and we need bread, we're still responsible for choosing not to steal it.
That's correct. And I think you said, I think, a magic word there, which is desire. So I think, you know, we would call desire, he would call love. I think that's a good way of phrasing it. Yeah.
No, but you're also responsible for gluttony, for not
overdoing it.
You don't have too much. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
That's where the reason comes in?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In moderation.
It's the same. I'm just going to expound the same theory. We're born with a need. Zeal, we don't know what it is. A lot of it's trial and error, finding the right things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
need a love, a desire.
Mm-hmm. Craving.
Cravings.
Yeah.
We have them, and then we start, but do not necessarily have the discernment to know which is the one that's going to ultimately fulfill us.
Mm-hmm.
The epicurean, you know, the hedonistic principle is, you, no matter what you went after, you on the earth, you eventually got tired of it. You needed more and more.
Yeah.
That was the downside.
Yeah.
So there's, what is it, what is it that fills the need? What is it that fills the need that you won't tire of?
Mm-hmm. And that would only be the divine.
That would only be the divine.
Yeah. So we do have a faculty of reason that should control consent, and we do have free will. Again, Dante is very emphatic about free will. In lines 67 through 69, those men who with their reason probe the depths perceive this liberty innate in man, thereby bequeathing ethics to the world. And it's Plato and Aristotle is who he's referring to at that point. I forgot to mention this concept of love is scholastic. And the scholasticism, actually, I didn't realize this, but got started with Charlemagne. And we think of, you know, the Dark Ages is a misnomer because we assume that not much happened during the Dark Ages, or what we call the Dark Ages, and that's just not true. It'd be better to call it the post-classical period. And in 1787, Charlemagne founded scholastic schools out of monasteries, is where they originally grew out of. And you had Thomas Aquinas and Anselm and Peter Abelard. And so this argument that's being made here is principally Thomas Aquinas from the scholastic, which means school, the schools. And those are the harbingers of our universities. And they started back in 1787. So we talk about the Renaissance as though there's this dead time between the fall of the Roman Empire and the Renaissance was just not true. You know, it's just not true. And then, again, Beatrice is going to take Dante further, you know, the reasons for which reason cannot know. And that's where Beatrice is going to come. And we'll talk about that when we talk about paradise and such. Any other comments? So we go to Canto 27, lines 121 through 142.
And they're continuing their climb upward. And he says, growing desire to be up there was rising in me with every step I took. I felt my wings were growing for the flight. Once the stairs swiftly climbed were all behind and we were standing at the topmost step, Virgil addressed me, fixing his eyes on mine. You now have seen, my son, the temporal and the eternal fire. You've reached the place where my discernment has now reached its end. I led you here with skill and intellect. From here on, let your pleasure be your guide. The narrow ways, the steep, are far below. Behold the sun shining upon your brow. Behold the tender grass, the flowers, the trees, which here the earth produces of itself. Until those lovely eyes rejoicing come, which tearful once urged me to come to you, you may sit here or wander as you please. Expect no longer words or signs from me. Now is your will upright, wholesome and free, and not to heed its pleasure would be wrong. I crown and mitre your Lord of you, Lord of yourself.
All right. Any thoughts there?
Question.
I'm sorry.
What does the word mitre mean in this case?
Well, you know, like a knight.
It's the Pope's hat.
But it is the Pope's hat. But it came from something.
Well, it's a verb, used as a verb in this.
I
interpreted it as an action that elevated his position.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I interpreted it as. I could look up.
His own boss.
Yeah. And so why would that be? That he is free to be his own boss. Well, he's been through purgatory. At the start of purgatory, this is one of the problems we're skipping so much. Dante enters purgatory, he has seven P's put on his forehead. And the P's stand for sin. And I forget the Latin or the Italian word for sin, but it starts with P.
Like pejorative. It's pejorative.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Something like that.
Yeah. Do you know Italian?
It's close.
Yeah.
I've heard it somewhere.
Okay. And so at each step, you know, when it's envy, when it's gluttony, when it's wrath and such, as he goes through, he goes through the purgation process himself. And at each step, a P is removed as he goes higher and higher up the terrace. And now where he is at is the Garden of Eden. They've obtained the Garden of Eden as it was prior to the fall, and as it would have been had there been no fall. And so he's, you know, been gone through this purgation, and that's why he's free to be his Lord, is because the sins have been purged from him. Now there's additional steps that need to be taken before he ascends into paradise, but he has gotten through the act of purgation. The temporal fire mentions in line 127, the temporal fire, in line 28, the eternal fire. The temporal fire, that's measured by time, is purgatory, and the eternal fire is the inferno. So he's brought Dante through if you look at it. Now you have seen the temporal and the eternal fire, you've reached the place where my discernment has reached its end. So again, this recapitulates Dante's travels through the inferno and through purgatory. And then I think we are on to reading number 4, which is a long one. It's Canto 30, 22 through 75.
And so we're finally going to meet Beatrice. Sometimes, as day approaches, I have seen all the eastern sky a glow of rose, the rest of heaven beautifully clear, the sun's face rising in a misty veil of tempering vapors that allow the eye to look straight at it for a longer time. Even so, within a nebula of flowers that flowed upward from angels' hands and then poured down, covering all the chariot, appeared a lady. Over her white veil and olive crown and under her green cloak, her gown the color of eternal flame. And instantly, though many years had passed since I last stood trembling before her eyes, captured by adoration, stunned by awe, my soul that could not see her perfectly, still felt, succumbing to her mystery and power, the strength of its enduring love. No sooner were my eyes struck by the force of the high piercing virtue I had known before I quit my boyhood years, then I turned to the left with all the confidence that makes a child run to his mother's arms when he's frightened or needs comforting, to say to Virgil, not one drop of blood is left inside my vein that does not throb. I recognize the signs of the ancient flame. But Virgil was not there. We found ourselves without Virgil, sweet father, Virgil to whom for my salvation I gave up my soul. All the delights around me which were lost to our first mother could not keep my cheeks once washed with dew from being stained with tears. Dante, though Virgil leaves you, do not weep. And this is Beatrice talking now. Dante, though Virgil leaves you, do not weep, not yet. That is, for you shall have to weep from yet another wound. Do not weep yet. I sensed the regal sternness of her face as she continued in the tone of one who saves the sharpest words until the end. Yes, look at me. Yes, I am Beatrice. So you at last have deigned to climb the mount. You've learned at last that here lies human bliss.
Other thoughts?
One is, I really like this evocation of a sunrise. And what it reminds me of is going camping. You know, we're locked in our houses, and the sun's typically up by the time we unlock the door and go outside, so we don't really sit there. And even if we tried, unless our house is on a hill, we're not going to see the sunrise. And but it reminds me of going camping and just seeing as the sun comes up, being a, aware of that. Beatrice appears in the colors of the theological virtues, and the white veil is faith, the green cloak is hope, and the red gown is charity and love. And of these, seeking after these, there can be no excess of seeking after faith, hope, and love. These virtues differ from those cardinal virtues that can be obtained by human effort. These faith, hope, and love cannot be obtained by human effort. They have to be attained by faith. And so this is the point at which we were talking about Virgil can only take us so far, and faith has to take us beyond this point. This is Dante. It's only once that his name appears. And it's very important because this is a axis on which the comedy depends. And from this point on, it's personal. Up to this point, the pilgrim could be anyone or every man. The pilgrim was every man. From this point on, it's Dante, not just the pilgrim. So it's much more personal for him going forward. And then Beatrice is coming in at this point as well. I recognize the signs of the ancient flame is actually from the Aeneid, and in the Aeneid, Dido pledges faithfulness to her husband, who was actually cremated. So she pledged faithfulness to his ashes, and Aeneas shows up. And she feels the ancient flame and falls in love with Aeneas. So it's interesting here, right before Virgil disappears, there's a quote from the Aeneid, which is an interesting juxtaposition. One of the things is that Beatrice does not comfort Dante. So here, if you remember, the whole fiction of the poem is that Beatrice came down to the pilgrim, or came down to Virgil and asked Virgil to take the pilgrim all the way through the infernal and purgatory. And so she was acting in a very loving fashion. And then when Dante really runs into her, she's very strict and stern and accusatory. She actually accuses Dante of adultery and going after things and leaving her and abandoning her. And the question is, did Dante actually do that? Probably not. But what she represents is the faith and the talent that he had, and he put it to lesser purposes. So he lived a life of lesser purpose, and that's how he abandoned the spiritual Beatrice. God gave Dante unique gifts, and Dante used them for lesser purposes, and lower forms of poetry. And he became destructive of the gifts that he received from God. And he gets the what for from Beatrice, not just this little passage here. This is just an introduction to it. But Dante has to go through additional purification before he's ready to go to paradise. Thoughts?
So paradise is not the restoration of Eden?
The restoration of Eden is in purgatory. It's the top, think of it as a mesa. So it's the top of the Mount of Purgatory is the Garden of Eden. And one of the things he's going to see is a pageant, an incredible pageant. And the chariot is the church. And there's a Again, I have to leave out an incredible description of the church, or of the chariot. It's pulled by a griffin. And the griffin is an eagle and a lion, is it? Eagle and lion. And so it's a Christ figure of, you know, two natures in one is pulling the chariot. So Christ is pulling the church. And there's an incredible description of the church and who is accompanying the chariot. And we're going to talk some about what happens to the history of the church from the ascension of Christ to Dante's time. And so we'll start with, I guess it's number 32, lines 100 through 129.
Okay, this is Beatrice speaking at first. A short time you shall dwell outside the walls. Then you, with me, shall live eternally, citizen of that Rome where Christ is Roman. Now for the good sinners in your world, observe the chariot well, and see, and what you see, put into writing when you have returned. Thus Beatrice, I obediently, devoutly, at the feet of her commands, gave mind and eye to satisfying her. No bolt of lightning flashing through dense cloud, shot from the furthest regions of the sky, has ever struck me with such velocity as moved the bird of Jove, who then swooped down and through the tree, tearing off newborn leaves, rending the bark, destroying all the blooms. With his full force, he struck the chariot, which staggered like a ship caught in a storm, careened by waves, tilting starboard and port. Into the cradle of the glorious car, I saw a fox leap up, so lean it seemed the food it fed on had no nourishment. My lady made it turn and run away as fast as its weak skin and bones would go, accusing it of foul abominations. Once more the eagle swooped down through the tree, this time into the framework of the car to shed some of the golden of its golden feathers there. Like sorrow pouring from a grieving heart, a voice from heaven was heard. My little ship, oh, what ill-fated cargo you must bear.
Are there any thoughts there?
What's the bird of Jove?
Well, that's actually what we're going to talk about. So this is the history of the church. And there are... So number one is the Roman emperors, okay, that are... This is through the tree of knowledge. And the... let's see if I have my notes correctly, of course. First, before we do that, what do you think of this Rome where Christ is Roman? What is that referring to? I'm sorry?
City of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of heaven. You've got, isn't it interesting? Rome where Christ is Roman. So it's the persecutions of the church under Nero. So number one is persecutions of the church. See how it's described as tearing, rendering, destroying, striking with full force, which staggered like a ship caught in a storm. And so that you can see why that might be the persecutions that the church experienced under Nero and Diocletian. And then the second, which is 118 to 123. Into the cradle of the glorious car saw a fox leap up, so lean it seemed the food it fed on had no nourishment. My lady made it turn and run away as fast as its weak skin and bones could go, accusing it of foul abominations.
What might that be?
Is that a pope?
Well, it wouldn't be a pope by this point. It's the schismatics. For instance, these are internal heresies. No, all the heresies that, got to look it up. Is it E or not E? Thank you.
I did go to college, folks.
They don't teach you how to spell there.
No, they don't. So it'd be E as well, heresy.
I just
thought it was I-E-S. Yes.
There you go. Just doesn't look right. Can you name one of these heresies that occurred?
Gnostics?
Yeah, Gnosticism.
Gnosticism.
So they're internal heresies, and look how they're described as a fox, you know, wily like a fox. And what is the nature of this fox?
Skinny.
Yeah. And as though it has no nourishment, right? So the heresy was not able to nourish the fox. Well, I thought you were going to say something. And then the third seed, the eagle swoops down and into the framework of the car itself and deposits some golden feathers.
You have some thoughts about that one?
Is it the combination of church and government?
Mm-hmm. But in what way? It's not so much the blending of church and state. That's Constantine, right? Mm-hmm. So you have the eagle. So the eagle was represented, you know, the bird of Jove. The standard of the Roman Empire was the eagle. So the bird of Jove is the eagle. And so the eagle, which swooped down here, persecuted the church, now swoops down into the cart. Constantine becomes a Christian. And it deposits its golden feathers there. And this is the donation of Constantine, where Constantine made the church the religion of the empire and put it on a footing of you know, financial security. Now, one of the The donation of Constantine refers to actually a fiction, which is that when Constantine moved the Roman Empire capital to Constantinople, that he gave the church the temporal authority, so government. So he blended church and state. Remember, last week we talked about the two sons becoming one. And that Constantine not only made Christianity the religion of the empire, but he gave away the Western Empire to the popes. And that's where the popes got all the money and the power and, you know, a secular authority and such. This was proof that there was never any donation, but the popes used that as but we were given this. This is our right to exercise this power. And until that was proven false, that was the basis for much of the corruption in the Catholic Church.
Was that a document that was written that was just phony?
It turned out that, you know, they figured out that it was phony, that there was no such thing as a donation of the Western Empire to the church.
But he did give the church all of the buildings that were temples to emperor worship.
Yeah, to convert to churches. Yeah. And he made so there is an element of Constantine gave a lot to the church, making it the official, Christianity went from a minority religion
that was persecuted to the established religion that actually became persecuting because it had the authority of the state behind it. And so it totally, and some people feel that's when Christianity, in a sense, lost its innocence, is when it developed a relationship to the Roman Empire. Because it, in a sense, climbed in bed, so to speak, with the Roman Empire. Other comments?
Well, Constantine supported his mother Helena to go to Jerusalem.
Yes.
The military power to choose the spot.
Yes.
For historical spot. Is that a donation or?
Well, no, the donation, there's several things. One is what Sam is talking about, which is Christianity became the religion of the empire. It was endowed with it was endowed with property in terms of the churches and finances and so forth. So it instantly went from an impoverished religion where people practiced it because of their belief system to a state-established church. It'd be like, the Church of England, in Europe in particular, there are state churches that are established, and people pay taxes to those churches. Well, see, that's what would have occurred after Constantine, or with Constantine. Other thoughts? And then 130 to 160.
Then I saw the ground between the wheels opening up. A dragon issued forth, driving its tail up through the chariot. Then, as a wasp withdraws its sting, that thing drew back its poison tail, tearing away part of the floor, gloating as it wandered off. The rest, like fertile soil left for thick weeds to thrive on, grew a rich cover of plumes, granted with good intentions, it would seem. And all the chariot, with both its wheels and pole as well, was overgrown with them in less time than it takes to heave a sigh. Thus changed, the holy shrine began to sprout. Heads from all parts, three on the chariot's pole, and one from each of the four corners grew. The three were horned like oxen, but the four had but one horn upon each of their heads. No one has ever seen a monster like it. Seated thereon, securely like a fort high on a hill, I saw an ungirt whore casting bold, sluttish glances all around. Acting as if someone might take her from him, a giant I saw standing there by his side. From time to time, the two of them would kiss. But when she turned her roving, lustful eyes on me, her lover, in a fit of rage, beat her ferociously from head to foot. Then, furious with jealousy, the giant ripped loose the monster, dragging it away far off into the woods until the trees blocked my sight from the horror and that strange beast.
That's a pretty vivid passage, isn't it?
You know, Dante, again, Martin Luther has nothing on Dante. Because he's describing what... we have a fourth scene. And that is, I saw the ground between the wheels opening up, a dragon issue forth, driving its tail up through the chariot. Then as a wasp withdraws its sting, the thing drew back its poison tail, tearing away part of the floor, gloating, it wandered off.
Thoughts? Is he talking about that the church been moved to France?
That's when we get down to the last part of it is, about the ungirt whore being hauled off.
Yeah. He's talking about the church isn't quite so good as it used to be.
Yeah. This recalls the Satan in Revelations 12:9. And the great dragon was hurled down, the ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. And so this is thought to represent schismatics.
And
I did go to college. Is there?
Thank you, guys. That's plagued me all my life. Particularly Islam. Right? There's some thought that particularly Islam was this dragon that damaged the church. And the dragon wanders off, right? Doesn't say the dragon was killed. Dragon wasn't destroyed. So there's the dragon is still alive and has the potential to come back. So the dragon wandered off, but the dragon did not go entirely away. And then in the fifth scene, like fertile soil left for thick weeds to thrive on, grew a rich cover of plumes granted with good intentions in the scene. And all the chariot, with both its wheels and pole as well, was overgrown with them in less time than it takes to heave a sigh. Which is the fifth scene.
Any thoughts about what might be going on there?
How about acquisition of wealth and power?
And specifically, it turns out that there was a second donation, and this one actually happened. It's a donation of Pippin. Who was one of the first Holy Roman Emperors, and in AD 754 he actually gave money to the church, and in essence corrupting the church at that point. So he did this in 754 and 756. And in return, so this was a bribe, and in return, Pope Stephen II anointed Pippin king of the Franks. So Pippin had money and wealth, and he gave that to the church, to Pope Stephen II, and as a result, Stephen II anointed Pippin king of the Franks in 754.
Was Pippin the son of Charles Martel?
I'm sorry?
Was Pippin the son of Charles Martel? Is he in that lineage?
Could be. Father of Charlemagne.
His father is Charlemagne. He's the son of Charlemagne.
No, father of Charlemagne.
Father of Charlemagne, okay. Then,
And he could very well be in the but I don't know the relationship to Charles Martel. In return, the Pope Stephen II got the papal states in Italy. So he got land and power in the center of Italy as a result of anointing Pippin king of the Franks. And Charlemagne confirmed the donation in AD 775. And so this increased the church's holdings. It transformed the church into a powerful medieval state. So again, this was a corruption of the church that occurred when it was given power and money and land. So number six. Let me get oriented here. 142, 147. Thus changed, the holy shrine began to sprout heads from all parts, three on the chariot's pole, and one from each of the four corners grew. The three were horned like oxen, but the four had but one horn upon each of their heads. No one has ever seen a monster like it. Is there a book in the Bible that this kind of reminds you of?
Daniel.
Daniel, yes. Daniel. Revelation. Revelation. And it's Revelation 13:1, seven heads with ten horns. And what is exactly does it represent? This is not entirely clear. The general degeneration of the church? Does it represent the seven deadly sins, the ones with two horns being pride, envy, and wrath, which is sin against God and against man? And then one horn, sloth, avarice, gluttony, lust, sins of the flesh. This is not entirely clear. Another possibility is that in AD 1000, Pope Sylvester II appointed seven electors to select the Holy Roman Emperor. As previously, the emperor was chosen by God by heredity. This was the thought that God chose, you know, according to the children, you know, that the king had. One of them became a king, firstborn became king. And since God chose that person to become king, as opposed to having seven electors that elect the Holy Roman Emperor. So this is an unnatural intrusion of the Pope on secular power. So there's a number of things we could put here. So we have the... you know, does it represent a papal power? Corruption of the church? Or the seven deadly sins? So the identity of number six is not quite sure exactly what that is referring to. And then the seventh scene, 148 to 160, where there is a ungirt horde casting bold, sluttish glances all around. And then there's this monster, or the giant, that drags it away off into the woods. And this gets back to what you're talking about. This is the corrupted papacy, specifically Pius the Third. The ungirt horde. Again, which book of the Bible is that from? Right? The imagery. The imagery is from Revelation. Right? So... he had Pontius the and then the Babylonian captivity of the church. Which is when the papacy was moved to Avignon, and since the it is hauled off, the papacy is taken out of Rome. The jealous giant is likely Philip the Fair of France, and this kissing between the giant and the whore is the alliances that they are forming. Philip laid siege to the papal palace on September 7, 1303. Boniface was captured and humiliated, and which would go along with lines 154 to 156. And then his successor, Clement V, allowed the papacy to be moved to Avignon. So let's look at Canto 33, 52 to 145.
Note well my words, what I have said to you. You will repeat as you teach those who live that life which is merely a race to death. And when you write, be sure that you describe the sad condition of the tree you saw despoiled, not once but twice here on the spot. It is my wish you carry back with you, if not my words themselves, at least some trace as pilgrims bring their staves back wreathed with palm. And I said to her, as wax stamped by the seal will never lose the outline of the print, so your seal is imprinted on my mind. Reader, if I had space to write more words, I'd sing at least in part of that sweet draught, which never would have satisfied my thirst. But now I've completed every page planned for my poem's second canticle. I am checked by the bridle of my art. From those holiest waters I return to her, reborn, a tree renewed, in bloom with newest foliage and immaculate. Eager to rise, now ready for the stars.
Okay, any thoughts as we prepare to go to paradise?
Dante didn't turn the other cheek too much unless it was a slapping.
I'm sorry?
Dante didn't turn the other cheek too much unless it was a slapping.
No, he didn't. In fact, he ended up being a party of one. And because he decried corruption, and he decried corruption of the Ghibellines, of the Black Party of Guelphs, and eventually of his own party, which were the White Guelphs, and how corrupt they were. And he said, I've become a party of one. And, this initiated actually writing the Divine Comedy. This, of course, is Dante's final address, and he implies he has more to say. But he structured his poem to have 33 cantos per section, so he's run out of ink, so to speak, and he has to wrap it up. But Dante has gone through a rebirth and a new life, a purification process while in the Garden of Eden that we've skipped over, and now he's ready to ascend into paradise, and so are we next week into paradise. Any thoughts before we close?
We made it
through purgatory.